Hello, I'm Jay Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I am joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
And one of our contributors, Ashanti Omka.
Hello.
Hello, you two. So this week we're reviewing David O. Russell's Amsterdam, Female Action of the Woman King, BJ Novak's Vengeance, and the reissue of Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. But first of all, before we get to those, what have you guys been up to this week? Jordan, what have you been doing?
So you may well know that the London Film Festival kicked off yesterday as we speak. So I've been hoovering up as many films as possible playing at the festival, like Empire of Light, Women Talking. I've seen Bardo, and a film that's currently embargoed by the time this goes out. But the standout for me so far has been Tar, which is director Todd Field's first film in 16 years and stars Cate Blanchett as a fictional world-famous conductor called Lydia Tarr, who is a very problematic character, to say the least. Peerlessly gifted at what she does, but a serial abuser of her position of power. I've always been sort of fascinated by conductors because it's one of those professions where I've never really understood what they're doing on stage and
why just waving their arms about.
Exactly. Who knows what they're doing? But this film, it sort of fully explores that world and the world of professional philharmonic orchestras in a way that it actually really satisfied my curiosity in that sense. But primarily, it's a character study. And Cate Blanchett is pretty extraordinary here. I will be very surprised if she's not the clear favorite for Best Actress Awards going into the awards season.
I can't imagine she won't be on that list and hoovering up the awards. I mean, we still have time for some other performances, but she's certainly in the running. She's quite astonishing in this role, as you would expect. We will talk about that when that comes out in more detail, because there is a lot to talk about. But Ashanti, have you been LFFing?
I haven't been LFFing. I've been getting a lot of invites, though. And speaking of philharmonic orchestras, as Jordan mentioned, I'm still buzzing because I was at Royal Albert Hall last night for the 60 Years of Bond concert, which I didn't realize how much that music had stuck to me through life. So I had goosebumps, I had tears, it was euphoric. And, you know, seeing people like Dame Shirley Bassey performing, and Amazon Prime Video have got 25 Bond films that have just hit the platform as we speak. And for 60th anniversary of Bond, there's The Sound of 007, which so I kind of came home very late at night and wanted to watch it. And
which one did you choose? Which film?
I don't want to say it yet, Jane, because I've been given the heads up about the reader's question and I have picked something there. So I'm going to keep you as a tease until that comes out. So that documentary, though, The Sound of 007, very, very interesting. The other thing I have been watching on repeat, and I'm sure you have been too, is Marvel Studios' Black Panther Wakanda Forever official trailer when it came out. Again, I felt all these emotions when the first Black Panther came out. I watched it like 5 times, including at the European premiere. And that, for me, you know, bringing that all together has been absolutely amazing. And then to see this trailer and to see what they're going to do with it is huge. And another documentary I have to cite is the new Sinead O'Connor documentary.
Nothing Compares to You.
Oh, Nothing Compares to You. What a beauty. I mean, I don't think I realized what she was about. I just heard the music, loved her voice, and took her as a given. And to learn about her life has been absolutely extraordinary.
Great. Well, shall we get on then? As LFF is kicking off this week, so we'll probably have lots to talk about next week. But for now, what we can go and see at the cinema, it's time to go to the Netherlands with this.
You don't get here without things starting a long time ago. So, two soldiers and a nurse found ourselves in
Amsterdam.
We formed a pact and we swore to protect each other, no matter what. Pact's the rich. We find ourselves in a situation where we're accused of killing someone, which is not true.
Ewan Woodman fled the scene.
The killer pointed at us.
We didn't do anything. Why would you possibly think that was us?
Well, there's not too many people that fit the description of a doctor looking for his eye on the ground with his black attorney.
Columbia Law School.
So this is Amsterdam, David O. Russell's latest, very, very starry period, based on a little bit of history, but not completely, Jordan.
Yeah, exactly. It's a story that has some basis in a real conspiracy to overturn American democracy in 1933. But for the most part, it is a fictionalized tale about three friends, Bert Berenson, played by Christian Bale, Valerie Vose, played by Margot Robbie, and Harold Woodman, played by John David Washington. They come together as a trio in a French hospital during the First World War and later relocate to Amsterdam, where they spend carefree days dancing, smoking pipes, and resolving to always protect one another until one day Valerie ups and disappears. Cut to a decade later, Bert is working as a pro bono doctor operating off the books to help wounded veterans, of which he is one with a bad back and a glass eye, which has a habit of popping out at very inopportune moments, while Harold is a lawyer of some repute. One day they find themselves framed for murder and on the run, and seemingly by chance are drawn back into the orbit of Valerie. So the three friends reunite to clear Bert and Harold's names and eventually find themselves face to face with insidious fascist forces at the heart of America, which is a very convoluted plot, as I'm sure you've gathered from that. It has a lot going on in this film, and for me it was a big swing and a huge miss, I have to say.
Huge miss.
It's a very odd mishmash of bohemian Jules A. Jim style romance and a sort of screwball murder mystery that gets sort of far too big and far too reaching for the film it sets up in its early stages. It's outrageously star-studded because, as well as Christian Bale, Margot Robbie, and John David Washington, you have Robert De Niro, Rami Malek, Anya Taylor-Joy, Mike Myers, Michael Shannon, Alessandro Nivola, Chris Rock, Andrea Riseborough, Matthias Schoenaerts, Zoe Saldana, Timothy Olyphant, and Taylor Swift.
Yeah, let's not forget Taylor.
Exactly, who is actually all right in this film, I thought. I didn't think she embarrassed herself. But it's one of those films where I felt like the famous faces ended up being more of a distraction than an asset to the film, particularly when you have people like Taylor Swift and Chris Rock popping up for a scene or two and not really having much of a character beyond the fact that they are these famous people who you just want to see in one of these films. And it's one of those films as well where everyone, because they have such little screen time, everyone has to pull out some strange affectation just to kind of make an impression. So Bale has his aforementioned glass eye and his facial prosthetics. Margot Robbie's character, she makes little trinkets out of shrapnel. Mike Myers' character is responsible for some kind of genocide in the bird population. I didn't really get what was going on with that character at all. So there's a lot of just very odd, disparate elements that are constantly feeding into a story which they feel just like completely the wrong fit for. I was sort of baffled by what exactly David O. Russell was trying to achieve in this film. I would say that everyone involved is sort of far too talented for it not to be intermittently entertaining and for it to spring into life occasionally. I think the Amsterdam scenes, as fleeting as they are, oddly fleeting given that this film is called Amsterdam. You're in Amsterdam for about 10 minutes maximum. They're really joyous and you really do get a sense of this unbreakable friendship forming. But the story that they characters then get inserted into takes far too long to come into focus for those two parts to effectively gel. And I just found it a very odd exercise.
Ashanti, you and I went to the premiere of this. We saw the stars on the red carpet and we enjoyed our popcorn whilst we watched it. We obviously had a little chat about it after that, but tell us what you thought of it.
I will just say, I think, a few words, style over substance. It was extremely stylish, fantastic, you know, decor, fantastic set design, beautiful costumes, you know, stunning people to watch. In fact, I don't think John David Washington has looked better in his career thus far. But sadly, I have to echo what Jordan has said. I feel like it lost the plot, literally. And we just couldn't get into what should have been a nice murder mystery. That would have just done it for me. But unfortunately, that's not quite what they gave us. And it just kind of meandered. And, you know, I feel like they just wanted to throw all these people at it rather than saying, let's just delineate it into a nice screenplay. And it just got very messy. And I somehow felt like this is a film I went into expecting a lot. And maybe my expectations were too high. And I came out kind of feeling really sad that there was a lot of potential that was wasted. At the same time, though, I have to say, performances-wise, you know, people like Anya Taylor-Joy, Zoe Saldana, they all give us beautiful performances, even though they appear very, very short in this film. But yes, I have to echo Jordan and you know, as Jane and I, we discussed this also, that we kind of sat there thinking, why? Why did you waste this opportunity, Mr. David O. Russell?
Yeah, I mean, because he can, I guess. Yeah, there's a sort of bombast to it as well, isn't there? That I can get all of these people and make them do sort of quirky arch things. And I'm at the height of my powers to be able to do that. So that sort of feels a little bit weirdly sort of showy offy for the sake of it. And then you sort of think about like things like Knives Out, that takes a large starry cast and does a murder mystery really well. And everybody does it without overplaying their hand and does it as a company. When you compare the two, I know which one's more entertaining, which one speeds along. I mean, I looked at my watch in this, I have to admit. And then like, why are you casting Mike Myers, who very famously appeared as Austin Powers, in a very comedic role, in a role where he wears, you know, blue contact lenses, this comedy wig, and talks in this fake British accent? It's like, what? Why are we doing this? And it just feels like, well, because we can, and people will accept it and will go and see it because it's this caliber of actor and it's this director. And actually, maybe that's not enough, Mr. Russell. Maybe that's not enough anymore.
I'm not really sure what someone like Mike Myers would get out of a film like this, because he has such little screen time, not much of a character, very little involvement in the plot, really. Just feels like it was an opportunity to work with David O. Russell, which, I don't know, is that a desirable thing anymore? He's obviously made some great films, but he's a very contentious filmmaker for well-documented outbursts on set, not treating his actors particularly well. I can't even imagine it's something that most actors even aspire to, is working with him. And I don't think that this is either his sharpest film or even close to his best film.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there is some controversial aspects to him personally that we won't go into, but you know, Silver Linings Playbook, yep, okay, I found that unbearable. but won Oscars. I actually think this is better than that, and I still think it's not very good. So I find it strange that he continues to manage to get the funding and the casting when he's problematic and also isn't producing work that's as good as, you know, someone like Rian Johnson is producing. So yeah, it's an interesting conundrum, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. I think the only thing I can think is that people see him as a bit of a shortcut to awards season, because he has had great success at the Academy, of course. He was really on a hot streak for a few years there, where everything he was doing was, you know, getting acting and Best Picture nominations. But I don't know, it feels like he's just gone off the boil, really, now.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think film's going to bother any awards, do you? I mean, possibly for, you know, production design and costume and makeup and hair, because it's gorgeous. But I don't feel like this is going to be coming into the conversation, do you?
I think it's telling that it's kind of been snuck out. Obviously, we've got, as mentioned, we've got the film festival season happening right now. TIFF and Venice are already done. The London Film Festival is happening right now. This film hasn't played at any of them. Film festivals now, particularly the fall season festivals, are seen as a first step towards Oscar glory, I would say. They've clearly made a very deliberate choice not to put this film in any festivals. So I don't think they have high expectations in terms of awards. And I can't imagine that they have high expectations in terms of box office either, which is crazy if you think about the kind of talent involved in this film, particularly on the acting side. All those people, and they're probably expecting a very muted opening weekend for this film, which is kind of extraordinary and tells you a lot about the film that they're in, really.
Yeah, Batman and Harley Quinn, you know, hanging around in
and
Amsterdam.
The protagonist from Tenet. Yeah.
And the protagonist from Tenet. What's not to like? Yeah. And yet quite a lot is not to like. Okay, so I think we're saying go and see this if you like these actors and you, you know, like David O. Russell's work. But otherwise, is it one to actually spend your money on this weekend?
I'd say give it a miss. Wait for it to pop up on streaming if you're really keen.
Okay, that is Amsterdam, and it is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, it's time to get your warrior on with this.
My king, the Europeans wish to conquer us. They will not stop until the whole of Africa is theirs. We must fight back for our people.
Maneska, you're asking me to take them to war. War.
Some things are worth fighting for. Don't know.
So this is The Woman King, Ashanti. Tell us who the Woman King is.
You'll have to wait to find out who the Woman King is. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Obviously, it is the queen herself, Viola Davis, who is by far one of my favorite actresses of all time. And this is by Gina Prince-Blythewood, who made films like Love in Basketball and The Old Guard. And she clearly has an eye for cinema, and bringing a film like this to life. I mean, I've seen it twice already. Once, you know, at a screening, and then watching it with the, you know, with the cast, Viola Davis and Thuso Mbedu, Lashana Lynch, Sheila Team, and John Boyega in front of me talking about it after the film, which had a rousing applause. I hadn't seen that kind of reaction to a film in a very long time. And that was absolutely amazing, because people are clearly very touched by what they're doing with this movie, where Hollywood has taken a stab at telling a story of the kingdom, the Dahomey kingdom, which was where Benin is now. And I grew up in Nigeria, very, very close to where that was. And I guess I never really thought about this story. I mean, you just think there were African Amazons. That's how they were described by Western history writers. And this is one time where they've gone back and done a lot of historical research, and they've tried to tell an emotional tale about these women warriors and what they were all about and how they did all they could to stop slave trade. Now, I know there's been a lot of discussion around this, because people always say, oh, it was the colonizers who took our slaves, and they forget the fact that there were lots of people, the insiders, and parts of in what's shown in this film is the Oyo Kingdom, which is in present-day Nigeria. And the Oyo Kingdom, for example, were, you know, were the kind of middle people, the Africans who were actually getting those slaves and then passing them on to these white slave traders. So this is the story that they have attempted to tell. And I feel like they've done it in a very effective and very strong, wonderful way. It's really vibrant. Viola Davis, I mean, in my eyes, she can never do anything wrong. I've never seen her miss a beat in any of her performances, apart from maybe a slightly dodgy African accent in this. But, you know, when you're watching this film, you have to remember that in reality, they're not speaking in English. They're speaking in an African language. So what we're hearing is their interpretation of what would have been said in the African language in English. Thuso Mbedu, wow, what can I say? She's a South African actress. She looks 15, but she's, you know, in her early 30s, completely shocking. She was in the Underground Railroad on Prime Video, and she is a revelation in this film. Absolutely stunning to watch. And Lashana Lynch plays a character that will steal your heart, is all I'm going to say. Sheila Ateem, a brilliant British kind of singer and actress from theatre. This role, I felt like they etched this role exactly for her. And John Boyega, he's Nigerian, he's got his roots in Nigeria, and he brought his best Nigerian uncle, as we called it, because the first screening I watched this at, they'd served us jollof rice, and or their version of jollof rice, and we all went into it, and it was a half-half split of people who had African and West African roots. So there were parts when John would speak in that accent and he would bring his best Nigerian uncle on as this king. And half of the audience laughed and the other half didn't laugh. It was quite interesting to see that, actually. And he plays King Gezo with a lot of fervor. I think it's a role that he has waited for, and it's been, you know, bestowed upon him. And the screenplay here, I felt really worked, because, you know, it is historical, but they have taken a lot of liberties, and they've brought this together in a very Hollywood fashion. So if this film was made in Nollywood, in Nigerian cinema, for example, it would have taken a very different turn. The production design, again, for this is absolutely brilliant. They had a, when you think about it, it's a $50 million budget, which isn't very big at all for a film of this scale. They use South Africa and the locales and the land to make it really pop in so many ways. You know, I felt like everything worked for it. The cinematography, I feel like this one will sit in the award race very, very, very nicely. I've seen it twice now. I probably will watch it again because it's gone into my kind of top 10 of the year straight away.
Mm. High praise indeed. I don't think you took a breath there, Ashanti. Do you want to have a little breather? Come on now. In and out, in and out.
In and out.
In and out. Jordan, was it breathtaking for you?
Yeah, I really enjoyed this one. The thing I was perhaps most surprised about it is that it just felt sort of straightforwardly entertaining in quite an old school way. Obviously, it has this very progressive story it's telling. It's about an all-female warrior tribe. That's something we don't see on screen all that often. A little bit Black Panther-y in that sense, but this is a film all about them. But what it really reminded me of were, you know, films like Braveheart and Gladiator and Last of the Mohicans. It just has that really solidly traditional, entertaining action adventure movie vibe to it, which I'm sure was obviously very deliberate. And I don't mean that as an insult at all, in the sense that I was just thoroughly entertained by the whole thing. It doesn't do anything particularly subversive in terms of the story it's telling. It's all stuff you've sort of seen before, but it does it. It's executed just extremely well all the way through. You get some pretty solid action in this film. Starts off very chaotic and then gets very choreographed as it goes on in a way that I found really satisfying. They're obviously very athletic and very accomplished fighters. So you get a lot of pivoting around, dancing over people, spinning around staffs and spears and using blades attached to chains and things like this in a way that was really, like, really cool, really showed off their fighting chops. And it was just dead satisfying to see someone like Viola Davis being the person who is involved in the showdowns, you know? Like, it's very rare that you see a 57-year-old woman who is the action lead in a big summer blockbuster. And I found that aspect of it really refreshing and really exciting, actually. Yeah, it's really very, very entertaining, is what I would say.
I haven't seen it, but it sounds like it would be very empowering to watch. And I'm really looking forward to that. I do love Viola Davis, and I know nothing about this story, so I'm really interested to discover it. And then maybe, you know, it will spur me on to read some more about it. And yes, obviously there are complaints about, you know, historical accuracy and, like, are we, you know, sugarcoating this sort of aspect of African history? But then we could say that about a lot of films, couldn't we? And I think it's a really good sort of starting point to explore this subject further. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
There were some, like, portions of attention to detail that I was really moved by. For example, the ritual of braiding the hair, for example, and the fact that, I mean, Viola Davis, when I was in front of her at the Q&A, she talked about this as well, that we normally see, like, swaying long blonde locks fighting, whereas in this case what you're seeing is black hair, and everybody has different hair. Black hair is a topic in itself, and it was really interesting. There's a scene where Lashana Lynch is braiding Thuso Mbedu's hair, for example, and there was also an LGBTQ+ aspect. I don't want to spoil it for you by telling you what it is, but that's something that you don't get. They show this in a very kind of seamless and beautiful manner, which again felt really good to me. I felt like they've taken a lot of time and thought behind putting the screenplay together and to actually showing this. And also a shout out to the costume design, because again, they have made an effort to find the finest African fabrics and to make sure that Ahome, the women of the Agogye tribe, are all wearing this beautiful costumes. And all of that really works together. And what Jordan said, I can echo that, where the sequences of the fighting, the choreography of the fighting, the emotion behind the fighting, all of that really comes through beautifully, which it doesn't often in this kind of movie. So, yes, props from me.
Okay. The Woman King is out in cinemas now, if you want to get into that. And I definitely do. I'm going to try and fit it in around LFF. Before we move on to our next film, it's time for alternative line reading. And as always, this is a line from a movie of someone we've discussed already, but delivered in the wrong accent or cadence. So I'm going to do it in the style of Dracula, Gary Oldman's Dracula. So tell me who said this. As a man, I am flesh and blood. I can be ignored. I can be destroyed. But as a symbol, I can be uncorruptible. I can be everlasting.
I can only clap at that, Jane. You
it, kind of, it kind of works.
Yes.
We've got to get on to Gary Oldman and his accent later. But for now, who said that?
Yeah, I know exactly who this is. I don't know if you want to go, Ashanti. Should I
go for
it?
No, go for it, Jordan. Your smile says it all.
It's Batman. It's Batman Begins, Christian Bale as the Dark Knight.
Thank you for being quicker than Jamie last week.
You saying that like that, it actually reminded me a tiny bit of Tom Hardy's accent in The Dark Knight Rises as well. You went a tiny bit Bane.
Did I?
So it was messing with my mind.
Lovely voice.
Yeah. I was like, this is definitely Batman. And it sounds like Bane's delivering his line a little bit. It was a lot of cross wires going on.
Okay. I aim to confuse. It does actually sound like this.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy. And I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored. I can be destroyed. But as a symbol... As a symbol, I can be incorruptible. I can be everlasting.
What symbol?
Something elemental, something terrifying.
Right, moving on. We're on a podcast, so it's time for a podcaster with this.
Abilene just didn't die. She was murdered.
What?
And the two of us, we won't avenge her death.
So as like a personal boundary, I don't avenge deaths.
But here's what I can do.
I'm gonna record everything that you think happened to Abilene. And we'll put it on a podcast and we'll see where it leads.
What evidence does he have that it was a murder?
Nothing. And that's the story.
What's this podcast about?
A new American reality where people invent these conspiracies.
You got deep state, pill pushers, cartels, the law.
Because the truth is too hard to accept.
My Prius exploded.
Oh my God. What if you were driving a real car with gas and stuff?
So this is Vengeance, BJ Novak's directed and written comedy. Bit of a generic title, Ashanti, but it's not a generic story. Tell us.
Gosh, yes, this is a black comedy is how I'd describe it. BJ Novak, interestingly, he's the godfather of Mindy Kaling's kids. He was in The Office with Mindy Kaling and they were this it couple for a long time. And I, as one of probably Mindy Kaling's biggest fans, always sees him as that attaché to Mindy. And it's really interesting to see him in his own right, you know, taking this huge kind of role and also like directing this. And in this one, it's produced by Jason Blum. I was expecting, when I heard that, I thought, oh, maybe there'd be a horror element to it. But no, there isn't. This is all about, BJ Novak plays this kind of, you know, hip New York journalist, Lothario kind of man who obviously sleeps with many women. And in this case, he gets a sudden call from the brother of one of those women who says that this girl has passed away and invites him over for the funeral. And this is where he gets to see Texas. He gets to hear from, you know, the family, because they actually give him her room to stay in. What was really interesting about this was that he suddenly thought, oh, and there's always a podcasting opportunity, I suppose, because as a journalist, he goes there, hears these people's views and opinions, which are completely different, calls up his kind of person on the other side who is played very, very beautifully by Issa Rae, who I absolutely adore. And he goes on this really crazy journey where he learns so much about the people of this little town in Texas and what goes on kind of behind the scenes, things that this guy clearly, he's completely in a different world from what he's used to. And let me just say that there's an interesting person in this cast, Ashton Kutcher, which I didn't expect at all. And he was a bit of a surprise person who appears in this as a music producer, who has this brilliant, amazing kind of ranch where he records artists. And it turns out that the girl that has passed away also has been an aspiring singer. So BJ Novak basically goes in, it's almost like he goes into an Alice in Wonderland situation and really immerses into this world with all these people. And he starts to learn about what's going on, how they party, the drug scene in this little place, things that you don't necessarily associate with the place he's in. And it just is one of those films that will surprise you every step of the way. I suppose I went into it completely blank, and watching it just took me in because I felt like the screenplay is very, very solid. And BJ Novak, he has these really intense eyes, and I feel like every piece of screen time he gets, he draws you straight into them, and they're so expressive. He has shown us in the past that he acts really well, but in this case, he's directed himself really well as well. A lot about this to like from my perspective. I felt like beautiful cinematography, the music really worked for me. And let's just say that it is a film of many surprises, and you learn a lot of social commentary that, you know, if you're watching the news and you're following American news, you'll certainly get it. And if not, you'll just learn a lot. So that for me felt really good. And I would say kudos to him for making such a bold film.
Yeah. Jordan and I saw it yesterday together and laughed like drains, didn't we, Jordan? It's really funny. But yes, I would agree with you, Ashanti. It is surprising. 100%, I should say. 100%, because that's what he keeps saying. 100%, 100%. Jordan, tell us what you liked about it and what made you giggle.
Yeah, there was loads I liked about it, actually. I thought this film was a bit of a gem. It's just really sharply written by Novak, who works primarily as a writer. Most people know him best as Ryan from The Office, of course, but he's gone on to have a very successful writing career. That there's a lot of, I would say, pseudo-intellectual speechifying about the state of the nation, about why America finds itself in such a divided place, which really could have been insufferable, but is often delivered with either its tongue firmly in its cheek, or I thought it actually made some quite convincing and thought-provoking points, which I was really surprised by. And it really sketches its characters just beautifully. You really warm to this family who take Ben in under their wing in Texas and accept them as one of their own in quite a loving way. There's a very funny scene where they're badly explaining to Ben why this chain called Whataburger is their favorite burger chain. And it's just so sweet. It's so endearing. It's so daft. But I absolutely fell in love with these characters just on that one scene. But it's also incredibly self-aware in quite a smart way, and is constantly commenting on what the film is doing as a piece of storytelling, because it has this story within a story format where he's creating this podcast about the story that he's currently living. So it allows him to comment on what's happening. So he's actually saying, oh, like, I love this family. Like the podcast producer, Eloise, played by Issa Rae, saying, oh, I love this family. There could be spin-offs about this family. And that's sort of the same thing that you're thinking at the same time. I love this family now. I've really warmed to them. So on that level, it's just an incredibly intelligent script. It's so dense, so multi-layered for such a relatively small story about one guy traveling to Texas to try and solve a murder mystery. But there's a lot more going on. It has its eyes on much bigger themes and ideas. But then the other thing it does is it just tells quite an effective murder mystery story, like just kept me guessing. I didn't really see the twists that were coming. I thought it tied itself together really neatly, really succinctly. It really just sort of delivers on every level that it's trying to, really.
Yeah, totally agree. I loved Boyd Holbrook in this. So underrated as an actor, and he's so good in this. So endearing, so sweet, so dumb, so weirdly smart, you know, like all of these things. And he sort of sums up everybody in this film. They are all things, you know, and you swing rapidly with everybody in this film, as you do with real people. Ashton Kutcher, I thought this was a revelation, actually. I adored him in this. His character is so interestingly written, and the way he sort of delivers it. There's a scene where he does a speech that should be the cheesiest thing in the world, that you're like, I could get that on like a poster and stick it on my wall. It's like, this man is incredibly sort of profound, and this scene is actually weirdly emotional. And then it flips that on its head. And I just love the fact that it kept pulling the rug from under you as an audience, and that you think it's about one thing, it's about another thing, but it's actually about this thing. But it's also about all of this stuff. Also, like, let's talk about Ashton Kutcher here. Do we want to see more of Ashton acting?
Yes, please. Definitely. I have to say a kudos to him for going through it. I mean, he has had some health issues. You know, he had like vasculitis, and I've had that. And I remember I was completely immobilized in my legs for a while. And how he manages to look so good and pull out this performance as he's done in Vengeance, and also having battled what he's battled, I say kudos to him. And yes, please give him more roles. Give him some meaty roles. This guy can do it. He's just been forgotten.
The pleasure in this is what you expect from Ashton Kutcher, and then what you don't get with this. It is a really surprising role. I would never have cast him as this. And I loved his scarf that he wore and sort of ridiculous douche top, solo cut top. Ridiculous. I mean, this man is an absolute parody, and yet he's one of the sort of most sort of believable people in this whole film. Yeah. Also, can we talk about the Texas stuff? This well-observed sort of humor about, you know, the difference between the people in Texas and the people from New York, and how never the twain shall meet. You know, you don't cheer for the wrong football team, you know, Frito pies, deep fried Twinkies, capon legs. You know, the foodstuffs alone is worth seeing this film for. But I did love that sort of fish out of water thing, and the fact that it constantly confounded that sort of stereotypical idea of what Texas is. It was really interesting. Yeah. And obviously the social aspects of it, the opioid crisis, the, you know, the border patrol aspects, the jurisdiction issues that come into it. It's just really, really interesting. It actually made me want to go on another road trip to Texas. I did one in November a couple of years ago, all around Texas, through the state, and drove those kind of roads, definitely ate those snacks, and visited the Texas Chainsaw Massacre house, which is now a restaurant, and ate a burger in it. But there were things I really recognised. What? Why would I eat a burger in there?
Why would you eat meat in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre house? Like, if you're going to get a veggie burger anywhere, come on.
No, it was great. Big, fat, crazy, juicy burger. Probably could have been head cheese for all I know. The toilets were through the doorway that Leatherface comes through, the sliding door. Honestly, can't recommend it enough.
Did it have the shutter? Could you like slam it down?
Sadly not. But the stairs, you know, like the wooden staircase up there. So you could, if you wanted to, run up those stairs, throw yourself out of that window at the top, trying to escape as the final girl. Yeah. And the restaurant is actually in the dining room area where, you know, so literally you're sat in there, you know, hit her with a hammer, daddy. It's amazing. It's amazing. And everything's exactly the same. It's not in the same location as the original house was, curiously. It's been moved about 20 miles, picked up and literally moved and plopped down in this different area. But in terms of the actual structure, it's exactly the same. So you can knock on that door and then wander in and end up in Leatherface's hook area having a little wee.
don't think I'll be visiting. Sounds a bit too scary for me.
Nope. And I also went to the gas station as well. So, you know,
Jane, you brave, brave woman. That's all I'm going to say. There's no way I'm going there. Absolutely not.
But, you know, but all I'm saying is Texas is a fascinating place, not just because, you know, there's Texas Chainsaw Massacre action there, but that this film really does capture that sort of the dichotomy of it as a state, and the vastness of it, and that it feels like another country. A character actually says at one point, you know, Dallas doesn't count. Austin's a different country, you know, and if you've heard of this place, we're 5 hours drive from that. So it's really sort of interesting about, you know, the people that are living in these very isolated areas and what they think about and how they view life. It's social commentary as well as everything else. So I think we're probably saying highly recommend. Get out and see this week.
Highly recommend. Yep. And I've just remembered that Ashton Kutcher does make an appearance in the Herogasm cameo in The Boys, which I guess we might all have to watch again just because we're now totally in love with this man. And he's got two movies, The Long Home and Your Place or Mine, coming out soon. So I feel like he's getting a renaissance, and he's got this this series called The Ranch. I wonder whether that kind of prepped him for this role.
Will he have that mustache? Because I love that mustache. It's very Burt Reynolds.
I'm going
to
go and find out, Jane, and I'll be reporting back to you. Because
I was like, Ashton, like, I think we could do a Smokey and the Bandit like legacy sequel with Ashton and the Tash and the Hat. I'm just saying, I'm putting that out there, Hollywood. I'd buy a ticket.
Me too.
So on that note, Vengeance is out in cinemas on Friday. Go and see it. Okay, welcome, my children of the night. It's time for this re-release.
Vampires do exist. This one we fight, this one we face. He can take on many forms. He is both young and old. He can appear as mist, as vapor, as the fog. And he can vanish at will.
Oh, my love.
The power of his evil desire has no end.
So this is Dracula. Jordan, it's the Coppola version, Bram Stoker's Dracula, with Keanu Reeves attempting an English accent and all manner of things. Well, I mean, basically, it's like Dracula on wheels, rolling into rooms with his baboon's bottom hairdo and all of the shenanigans.
It looks like he's floating, you mean?
Eyes in the sky, lurid colours, everything. Pure, like, 90s excess. Jordan, explain.
Yeah, so it's Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. Not the full title, but technically accurate. Obviously, it came out in 1992. It's generally thought of as not being very good, but at the time was actually quite a big box office success. Made over $200 million on a $40 million budget, nominated for numerous awards, and was generally well reviewed. And I have to say, I have very fond memories of this film. I really do quite enjoy this film. It's a grand gothic retelling of the Dracula story. It starts with Vlad the Impaler, played by Gary Oldman, in the mid-15th century. He returns from his glorious victory in his campaign against the Ottoman Empire to find that his wife, Elisabetta, played by Winona Ryder, took her own life after his nasty enemies reported his death in battle. A priest tells him that Elisabetta's soul has been damned to hell, and Vlad, completely enraged, desecrates the chapel, renounces God, plunges a sword into a stone and drinks some blood that pours from it and becomes the all great Vlad Dracul.
I mean, who hasn't done that?
Exactly. That's just a standard Saturday night for me. Don't know about you guys. Cut to the late 19th century. Jonathan Harker, played, of course, by Keanu Reeves and his incredible British accent. He becomes a representative for Dracula. He's a solicitor because Dracula has various business interests in London, properties that he wants to buy, that he owns. He travels to Transylvania to speak to him. And while he's there, Dracula sees a picture of Jonathan's wife, Mina, also played by Winona Ryder, of course. And he comes to believe that Mina is the reincarnated spirit of his beloved Elisabetta. So Dracula imprisons Jonathan at his castle, leaves him to be feasted on by his various brides, one of which played by Monica Bellucci, of course, quite famously. Mm-hmm. With Mina's location now known, Dracula travels to England, to Carfax Abbey. And while in London, he causes all manner of chaos. He hypnotically seduces Lucy Westenra, which brings Anthony Hopkins' Van Helsing into the picture, and then he eventually sets his sights on Mina herself. I'm sure plenty of people who listen to this podcast have already seen this film, so they already know the story. But I mean, I think this film is just an absolute joy. It's so grand. It's just so daft. The thing that really stands out to me is the production design and the costume design. You know, we've said a lot about great production design and costume design this episode, but this is one of those films which is just legendary for how beautiful it looks. The Dante Ferretti and Thomas Sanders, their sets are just absolutely incredible. Dracula's armor, well, Vlad's armor is properly iconic, just a great bit of movie costume design. I think it's actually now currently in Francis Ford Coppola's like winery or something. You just walk into his winery.
Well, it is a claret color, so it would sit very nicely there.
It's just absolutely beautiful. And this whole film is just gorgeous. All that is slightly undercut by some very odd casting choices. You know, we've made a bit of fun of Keanu in this discussion so far, and he's just badly miscast, really. He just can't do a British accent to save his life, can he? Like,
no,
there's just not a moment where that accent convinces, which is a shame. And I think he's well aware of the fact that he didn't live up to the standards he perhaps should have done in this film. And then you have Oldman himself, who really goes, you know, he dials it up to 11 in this film. Let's just say that nothing is held back. Everything is on the table. And I just find that really fun. I love when actors go for broke. And for me, it really pays off here. He's one of the more entertaining Draculas because, you know, at this time, vampires were in a very, I would probably say, campy place.
Yeah.
You know, you'd had Fright Night, you'd had The Lost Boys, you'd had various populist films in the 80s, which made vampires out to be a bit of a joke. This kind of recontextualizes what vampires are, what Dracula can be, makes it more of a gothic tale, more of a gothic romance, going back to Stoker's text, but then very much doing its own thing in terms of the look of the world, just super ambitious. Yeah, I love it when filmmakers, going back to what we said earlier with David O. Russell, I love it when filmmakers take a big swing. And for me, this one actually connects. It's not perfect, but I like it when people try, even if it's not 100% there.
Yes, I totally agree. It's one of my favourite films, but not because I think it's good. It's sort of one of those delicious things. Yeah, you're right. I would like to see this on the big screen because the production design and that sort, and the lurid lushness of it, you know, when people are riding carriages and it's got that sort of early sort of film aspect to it, and there's sort of glowing eyes in the sky. I can imagine on a big screen. I didn't ever see it on a big screen. It would look fantastic. But it is a joy to watch for Oldman, you know, putting his salt and vinegar on that set and just eating the scenery. You know, like there is nowhere he doesn't go with that. It's so over the top. It's ridiculous. We've got like weird, like wolfy things running around gardens, and Anthony Hopkins just going for it as well in circles of fire. I just absolutely adore it. It's just ridiculous and over the top and wonderful. I'll definitely be going to see it on a big screen. Ashanti, will you?
Yes, I would. I would love to see this kind of remastered for sure. I mean, it won 3 Oscars, Best Costume Design, Makeup and Sound Editing. And this is a film that, interestingly, I mean, VFX was really taking off in the 90s. And at that point in time, they didn't use as much of the VFX, but did this more, you know, kind of crafted it in the old style in many ways. And I remember I was quite young when I saw this, but like Winona Ryder's character, for example, really kind of captured me. And this whole idea, I think it might have instilled this weird thing in all of us, this whole true love never dies.
Yes, I've traveled oceans of time to find you.
exactly. And then all the spin-offs, I have to say, I am not into looking at monsters and all of those icky things, but somehow I got through this film and then became a huge lover of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel and all these spin-offs that kind of came with this as a basis. The vampire genre just rose in a huge way, and that for me, you know, what can I say? I'm here for it. And the fact that they're just like with Avatar, I kind of, you know, having seen that in 2009, and I thought, oh, am I going to like it again? Watching it in 3D, is the remastering going to be any good? And then I watched it, and it's, you know, it's been the number one film in the world for a reason when they brought back that old version. So bringing back certain films onto the big screen and remastering them, it takes a lot of effort, but I think it's really worth it because, one, a new generation gets to see these films, and two, I think some of these are true classics that need to be rewatched, and I'm here for it.
Okay, well, if you're here for it, do take your accent to the cinema to see Bram Stoker's Dracula on the big screen.
I know where the bastard sleeps. I brought him there to Carfax Abbey.
That's all we've got time for. Film of the week, guys. Jordan?
I'm going to go for Vengeance. Yeah, a real gem of a film.
Ashanti?
I'm going to go for The Woman King just because I'm going to watch it again. I loved it so much.
Yeah.
But I am with Jordan also on that. See both. See one after the other. See both because they'll both enrich your minds.
Indeed. I would say Vengeance and I definitely think you should go with a packet of Cheetos with some chili in it and some squirty cheese on top. Okay, we have time for a reader's question. Are you ready for this? What's the best train scene in movies? Ashanti, you teased this earlier. Tell us what it is.
I am going to say Skyfall. There is an epic train scene in Skyfall. And since all these Bond movies have just hit Prime Video, I feel like that's the one. I just thought, did Jane just know? Did it? Because I know Jane is an aficionado of all things Bond. You know, Jane is the only person I know who's literally been on Bond film sets and stuff.
Jordan so, as well. Jordan
and Jordan as well. Oh, wow. Now yeah. I know Jordan.
I was on Skyfall and... Yeah,
I was on No Time to Die. Yeah, you're the other one out, Ashanti. You need to get on the Bond set now.
I'm going to cry now because you know, were either of you at the Vardar Railway Bridge where they shot this scene?
Sadly not.
Okay. Because there's a similar bridge that the British built in Sri Lanka in a place called Ella. And people kind of hang off the trains to get their selfies and stuff. And this is similar in that sense. And what a spectacular scene. I mean, and you get to hear Judi Dench saying those famous...
Take the shot.
Take a shot, damn it.
It's also a cracking Bond theme, Skyfall, as well.
Oh, cracking in every way. So this is obviously the year to celebrate Bond at 60 years. So I'll go for that. But I also want to throw in one Indian train scene that I must not miss because Maniratnam's PS1, Ponniyin Selvan 1, is out on IMAX screens at the moment. I got to see it last week when it came out. And he's famous for bringing in a train scene, obviously not in PS1, which is a historical epic film that I recommend to everyone to watch if you can get to a screen and see that. But there's a film called Dil Se that he made with the music by A.R. Rahman and a song called Chaya Chaya, which is one of the most famous songs from Indian cinema, I would say, in many ways. And it has the one and only Shah Rukh Khan, who, you know, every country I've been to has mentioned Shah Rukh Khan to me in some form, like Morocco, or, you know, you go to Indonesia and someone will say, oh, I love Shah Rukh Khan. So he has that big following. And this is a song that is on epic scale where he is dancing on a train. Gorgeous Malaika Arora is dancing also. And there are loads of people on the train dancing while they're traveling from place to place. And it's this epic, epic score that that A.R. Rahman's taken some Punjabi kind of poetry and turned it into this banger of a song. And that also is another epic train scene that I have to cite. Please watch that on YouTube in HD because you'll be impressed.
Good. Jordan, what train is leaving your station? Where are you going? Which one?
I thought when Ashanti was going to pick a train scene from a Bond film, she was going to pick From Russia with Love, because that is the great one that first comes to mind. And of course, that Spectre references in its train scene very much. So that is an absolute classic. I absolutely love that scene. I'm going to pick the opening of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, though. Which of course features a young Indy played by River Phoenix. And it's sort of a humorously abridged origin story for Indy, where he basically inherits all the kind of traits and characteristics of the man he is to become in the span of like 8 minutes, I think it is. So he learns to hate snakes. He falls off his horse, all these various things. It's just done in a really tongue-in-cheek and fun way. And of course, it's one of the few action performances, I guess you would say, that we got from River Phoenix, who died tragically young. So it's always a treat to see him, even if he's on screen for only a matter of minutes.
Yes, indeed. Love the old snake thing there. It's very clever. I'm going to go for Some Like It Hot. We're in the age of the blonde discourse. So let's big up the lovely Marilyn and the wonderful scene on the sleeper train from Chicago, from the Chicago Valentine's Day Massacre down to Florida with the syncopated ladies band featuring two ladies who are not quite what they seem. And the lovely Sugar Cane, who is Marilyn Monroe chipping away at her ice block in her sink so that she can make Manhattans in a hot water bottle. She is so lovely in this, and it feels like it sort of sums up her as well when she sort of says, you know, why do I always get the fuzzy end of the lollipop? Yeah, so I think it's very bittersweet, but also just delightful. And that's a great, great film. And she has never been more wonderful than she is on that. She's just luminous. So that would be mine. Do let us know your favourite train scenes in movies via Twitter. But for now, I think we'll say goodbye. We'll blow our whistle. It's time for this train to leave this station until it returns on its scheduled timetable next week with more films. So say goodbye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
007, Triple X.
Bond, what do you think you're doing?
Keeping the British end up, sir.
You know.